It's Robert Taverner. I'd like to welcome you to the third of the Royal Academy LSE lectures in the series Spread Height Impact, which is running through this term and next. Some of you may remember that the first lecture was on King's Cross, which was looking at the spread of, over quite a significant area of London around the new railway station and the work that Graham Morrison and Dimitri Porphyrios were doing there. Height, we looked at the tall building that are being proposed for the City of London at the moment. And this week, with Sir Richard McCormack, we're going to look at a proposal that is working its way through negotiations at the moment for Victoria Embankment. Now, these are all projects that are happening imminently or potentially fairly soon if certain buttons are pressed. So they're large-scale projects that are going to have definitely an impact on our image, our understanding of London. It's going to change if these projects go ahead. And so it's an opportunity, really, through these lectures, both to present them to you via those who have designed them and also to get some feedback from you in relation to them. Now, Sir Richard McCormack, who's speaking tonight, is chairman of a very well-known practice, McCormack, Jameson, Pritchard, which has been operating since 1972. And it made its name in relation to social housing initially in Milton Keynes, but then through competitions and the success of the building products themselves, the practice has built a number of college buildings at Oxford and Cambridge. And you may well know the Wellcome Foundation building at the London Science Museum, the new wing there with the big blue wall, which is also at the outcome of this practice. They have worked on large-scale public realm projects before in Coventry, the Phoenix Initiative, which is something which has been going on for some time, which has been looking at public spaces there. And so as a practitioner, Sir Richard has a very great experience of this type of project. I should say also that it's an extraordinary office that he runs, because there are many well-known architects in practice today who have worked with him at some time or another. It's very much a breeding ground, I suppose, in a way, for young architects. And I think that's really because, as an architect, he's someone who's very happy to debate architectural principles, largely because he has very firm foundations. He knows what he wants to do and where appropriate references should be made. So it's a very great pleasure to welcome Sir Richard McCormack this evening. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Robert, for generous remarks. I'd like actually to start by thanking our client, actually, the GLA, and in particular Ricky Burdett, who you all know, of course, who's been very supportive, and our various consultants. No, before the consultants, actually, I should also say that this project is a kind of collaboration not only between design disciplines, but it's kind of another kind of collaboration, because it's a project that not only involves the GLA, but involves the two great cities of London, that is to say, the City of London itself and the City of Westminster, because they're both, as it were, landowners and have this great site running through them. And also Transport for London, Cross River Partnership, English Heritage, and so on. And what's been, I can say quite honestly, without sort of seeming to sort of schmooze people, that what's been remarkable, perhaps in the climate of England, almost a bit surprising, is that everybody so far is pointing in basically the same direction. So it's kind of moving along. But it is actually, I should also make clear, at a pretty early stage. It's in a almost in a feasibility stage. It's not a complete master plan. We're hoping it'll be further funded for us to continue work early next year, or at least by the spring. These things are quite slow. Our consultants, I do wish to acknowledge and thank, because it is very much a team effort. It's Alan Baxter, who's helping us with the relationships between highways and pedestrian movement, along with Space Syntax, Robert Townsend in landscape, Vivian Lovell of Modus Operandi in public art, Spears and Major in lighting, WT Partnership or Qantas Affairs, and my colleague and co-director Mark Hines is the project architect for this project, and we owe a great deal to him. The first image I'm going to show, I discovered this print in, I think it's in Sutherland's in Sackville Street a few weeks ago, and I think it's from the Illustrated London News, late Victorian image of London, post, it's probably the 1880s, because it was pointed out to me just now that the law courts are in the background. I think it's very pertinent to the project because it represents an image of London, a very, very powerful image of these two cities, which is such a peculiar characteristic and special characteristic of London. The commercial city, which originally was the Roman city, and the city of Westminster as the royal city, which I think was a Saxon city, which didn't actually join together till sort of fairly recent history, really. And what's interesting about the print, and what's interesting, I think, about the embankment, is that you can see the connection between the two cities in the print. That's what it's about, really. There aren't many places where you can really sense the relationship between the two cities. But the embankment, the Victorian embankment, is one of those places. The bridges, of course, the radial bridges across the Thames offer you that view, but the singular place that makes this fantastically important connection, conceptual and visual connection, is the Victoria Embankment. The other thing that this image picks up, which I'm going to bring back into the sort of argument, is the way in which the primary link between the City of London and Westminster, at least Trafalgar Square, is Fleet Street and then the Strand. And that's a very, very strong link. It works as a very strong link. And it runs parallel to the Victoria Embankment. But as I shall show, that the connectedness between the two is pretty weak, actually. And the other issue, which perhaps we can bring into mind at this juncture, is the other parallel route that one thinks of is the South Bank, bearing in mind the extraordinary way the South Bank has changed over the last 20 years or so. I live in Spitalfields, and from time to time I walk across Tower Bridge and I go along the South Bank, and if I'm feeling energetic I go to the Fars Festival Hall. Sometimes when I'm feeling less energetic I go to Tate Modern and cross the Millennium Bridge and walk back through the City of London. Now you'll notice that I haven't mentioned the Victoria Embankment. Only when I got this job, to start this project, did I start wondering why, in this circuit that I do, I don't walk along Victoria Embankment. And that's a really interesting question, and there are quite a few reasons, I think, which will sort of come out, and maybe it could be a discussion, which I won't start with now. This is another important image, I think. Somerset House, which is incidentally the first government office building, is a very Pyrenean building, absolutely wonderful building. Of course, it put its feet in foundations in the Thames. And there's great water gates into Somerset House. And that relationship, of course, was totally destroyed by the Victorian Embankment. I can't imagine English heritage letting something like the Victorian Embankment readily happen today, because it's actually wrecked the original relationship which this great building had with the river. And what's really important to sort of remember and think about is that the Thames was incredibly much wider than it is now. The kind of shorelines, the strand in the real sense of the word, was sometimes hundreds of metres in from the existing embankment that Bazalgette made. I should say that this project is part of a number of the mayor's projects and other public space projects, Sloane Square, Exhibition Road, the Lower Marsh in Lambeth, and so on, of which perhaps the first and very important one has been Trafalgar Square, and the other big Foster project, which is Parliament Square, and those projects are very important in relation to the project that we're looking at. So what this slide shows that as you can see in the lower right-hand corner, there's the embankment itself. There's a sense that actually the Thames is the subject of this project in a way, and the South Bank is this teasing kind of successful and very, very different kind of environment. So what is the sort of complementary nature of those two environments? They're linked by a ladder of bridges, which, to go back to my sort of admission that I haven't on the whole walked along the embankment until I started doing the project in my perambulations, partly because the bridges, of course, don't come into the embankment, they go into the Strand. So the ladder is quite difficult, unlike, say, the ladder of the Liffey, which is something that interests me very much at the moment for other reasons. And then there's this hinterland of most sort of lively kind, the Strand, Theatre Land, Covent Garden, some of the city itself, the city's great attractors like St Paul's, Tower of London, and then going west after Covent Garden and Trafalgar Square, St James's Park. So there's a great sort of challenge there. What relationship can we achieve? What relationships can we achieve with this hinterland? The embankment is a great, great engineering achievement. One of the great 19th-century engineering achievements, because it's not just about surface connections, though it was very much to do with transport. It's to do with sewers, and it's to do with the underground railway. And it was interesting for me, actually, a few months ago, hearing Jan Gehl talking about the modern future nature of cities and the extent to which the pedestrian should be taking over the surfaces of cities. And in his kind of provocative view, the connecting of parts of cities in the 19th century was to do with commerce. And he would argue that the connections now are to do as much, if not more, with recreation. And he made this provocative proposal that actually the 19th century city was a place of work, and you went out into the countryside for recreation, whereas the 21st century city maybe is a place of work, but the recreation is in the city, and people come into the city for its recreation. A place like Manchester is very, very interesting in that respect, where people who've got small flats in Manchester now want to live near the city centre. They want houses near the city centre. We've been looking at how you might do that kind of thing, very high density family housing, but that's kind of by the way. Can this be made into a recreational space? To what extent can it be? Well, that's the very important kind of argument, because I don't think this is a simply defined place. It's actually a place that performs in all kinds of different ways for different constituencies. It's still a very important vehicular route, and will go on being. even if the car eventually is not allowed into the space, it's still going to be an important public transport space. Did have trams, of course, until post-war period. I think what I'm going to try and sort of talk about is the various modes in which it might be used. It's a multi-mode kind of space to do with times of year, times of the week, times of day, times of night. It's not simple at all. Mark Hines, who's been working on this, found a wonderful historical, I'm not sure whether it's a letter or an article, saying, well, we had to be really careful with a kind of space like this in London, because it mustn't be like Paris. Because if it's like Paris, it would lead to looseness and immorality. And so the Victorian idea was this was part of London's industrial and commercial infrastructure. It wasn't somewhere where you were supposed to have fun. We think it should be. So almost the main gist of this project is to look at this multi-mode character of the space and to make a fundamental proposal that we can retain the traffic capacity, the four lanes, and that's what TfL want. I think that's what Westminster want at the moment, maybe not in the future. And we can do that and still double the roughly double the pavement dimension against the river, and probably plant another row of trees. And that begins to do something really interesting, I think, and starts me thinking about why I don't walk along this pavement. I think the reason I don't walk along it is something which I'm finding quite difficult to articulate, because I think it's subconscious. I think the traffic movement, which is fast and noisy and very close, is actually very, very menacing, and deeply uncomfortable. But we're so used to this relationship that we're forced into every day in this great city. We don't think about it. But when you have choices of being on the South Bank or the embankment here, the South Bank feels quite different. It feels it does feel safer, actually. What the extra row of trees does is it creates a kind of strange kind of protective zone, actually, I think, which you might walk in, of course, but you're walking near the river, you've then got this double zone. So that's kind of looking interesting. This is kind of repeating, sorry, it's the other way. I could murder the person in my office who drew this, because it reverses it at the top and puts it back in at the bottom. Anyway, it shows at the top what it's like at the moment. Then the second one down is what I've just shown sectionally. And then the next one is saying, and now I'm going to this notion of multi-mode, at certain times of the week, perhaps, or the year or whatever, it may be possible to close two lanes. So that actually, a Saturday afternoon or through Sunday, perhaps, I don't know. This is not negotiated yet. But we've talked to Transport for London about these sort of ideas. That, of course, raises very interesting detailed design issues, which I'll sort of come to. Can we make a road surface that feels psychologically comfortable to pedestrians? I mean, I don't know how many people here are familiar with the occasional closure of the Mall going up to Buckingham Palace, because actually walking in the middle of that sort of strange, lurid pink macadam, you feel actually incredibly exposed. You don't feel you ought to be there at all. so there's a important issue here of materials, and of course, what would be wonderful is if the pedestrian material, whatever that is, stone, went right across the whole thing. Very, very expensive. That's more or less kind of repeat, but showing more detailed dimensions, looking at traffic engineering. Trees are very scruffy there. I suspect that they're rooted in very poor material. It may have been, there may have been a lot of kind of building refuse thrown into the backfilling. up against the great retaining wall of the embankment, so that I think it may be possible to get a new row of trees to grow quite quickly and put in semi-mature trees, but we haven't really got to that yet. The other interesting thing, which I haven't illustrated as much as I might in this set of slides, is that the extra zone created on the embankment side could actually accommodate quite a lot of functions. The sort of worst thing it could do, and I sort of hope it won't have to, but it rather looks as though it may, is to actually accommodate all that coach parking. But what we have begun to think is that, again now thinking, why don't I walk along there, why is the South Bank seemingly more friendly, is actually there isn't any supporting sort of infrastructure. The South Bank has a kind of cafe or a pub about every 200 metres. There's nothing like that here, and the embankment walk is cut off, obviously, from the jumping and all singing and dancing sort of hinterland up in the Strand and Covent Garden and so on. So could we perhaps have in this zone that we're creating, this extra zone, long kind of canopied shelters, and ho-hum, the prototype for this is the cafe up on the Watkins Plaza, which we designed a few years ago, which is just a sort of glorified bus shelter, really, with a food, with food at one end, and it's kind of quite an interesting model. Maybe these canopies are only inhabited on a sort of licensed basis. Maybe they're not permanently a cafe. Maybe there's a kind of movable, I don't know, I'm thinking aloud now, facility that can come in summer. Maybe there are farmers markets there. Maybe there are art sales. Maybe there are secondhand books like in Paris, but also like underneath Waterloo Bridge. So maybe there's a whole range of attractors, including really good cafes and bars for people to come down from theatre land in the summer that can be put into this additional zone. You can see in the sort of background here, which shows very clearly the additional row of trees, some kind of glass, very light glass pavilion. This is also alluding to something which I suspect is going to be horribly controversial, which is that the view is into embankment gardens on the right, and this image proposes that the surface of the pavement along the river should continue right through across the road, and there should be a number of those crossings to make the rungs of the ladder, and they should go, those surfaces should work their way right through to the original edge of the river, which is, in the case of embankment gardens, is marked actually by the development along the edge. And then you start to connect up to the Strand there are various little routes there. And sort of spatially and aesthetically, what's been in my mind has been the quality of relationship between, say, the Mall and St. James's Park, or indeed the roads Constitution Hill and Green Park and the other side of St. James Park, where there's a peculiarly beautiful thing, particularly in summer and late summer evenings, when the sun gets under the tree canopies, and you get these long glades of sunlight and tree shadows going right across, hundreds of meters long, and an undulating sort of stripy landscape of light, which is continuous from the road surface, and is absolutely beautiful. Embankment Gardens has got, I'm getting a bit too expressive here. Embankment Gardens has got railings all the way around it, and that's to give people a lovely refuge for lunch on summer afternoon. Well, why do they need a lovely refuge? Only because the road is so full of bloody traffic and going very fast and it's noisy and so on. I don't know. Anyway, that's for the future struggle. Now this one, this is a very important one. I just love the idea that I'm old enough to remember London in smog, when it was absolutely impossible for any traffic to go anywhere, and the whole place was a playground, complete playground. Somebody in my office produced this image for fun in a way, But it suggests something quite extraordinary, actually, that you've been liberated from the tyranny of traffic. And it also says something else, which is a snow has made a continuous surface, which is there for everybody. Could one replicate that sensation, that idea, with the actual real surface? I mean, that'll probably be the next piece of work we do, is to really see how we can get a sense of continuous surface so that you don't have that mal experience where you step onto the lurid pink macadam, that you're actually going to be run over by cars. That there's a traffic management arrangement and a surface arrangement that gives the pedestrian confidence to be able to use the traffic surface when on certain occasions, you know, one would hope increasingly so, weekends and so on. This is an early image of Basil Gett's embankment, and this is actually up near Blackfriars. It's a big curved Unilever building, which is currently being refurbished, totally rebuilt internally, standing there at the moment. But this actually, in a way, does, although there are railings and so on, it does remind us that the embankment space did flow into the hinterland. The bottom left statistics are quite interesting. The contrast between the footfall on the embankment and the footfall in the Strand is important. And so also what Space Syntax have done for us in this project has given us a lot of other information of that kind, which, for example, show that the radial movement on the bridges, obviously in the rush hours from the railway stations to and fro, is enormous, bigger actually than the kind of linear movement along the river itself. What I don't have, maybe they have, I haven't taken in, is what the comparison is between the South Bank and the Victoria embankment on a weekend. And it looks to me as though the South Bank is pretty busy. And that is because of I think, partly because of traffic free, but also because of so many supporting functions and a lot of variety. So one of the things we need to do is to try and forge a kind of ladder up into the hinterland in the existing streets and alleyways. Some of those streets are very promising, and some of the alleyways are very unpromising, frankly. What we've been talking about, particularly with Vivian Lovell, the art consultant who's here this evening, is whether we can kind of draw people into this ladder, because there's some really extraordinary artworks, either integral or temporary, in those places that are attractors. This is an image of the Watergate on the north edge of Embankment Gardens, where the original Thames shore was. And it would just be wonderful, going back to that earlier image of the visual penetrability that one might be able to achieve in Embankment Gardens, if one could have a sense of this space, which almost seems to come up against a kind of shoreline here from the Embankment Walk itself. That's really just another image of improved links. But one of the things we've been looking at is either improving the piers or adding new piers. What I think is going to be very difficult is to sort of tidy up the floating structures, which used to be ships, but hardly are now. And there's an awful lot of, frankly, an enormous amount of kind of junk of a very sort of British kind floating along there, which we won't be able to get rid of, I suspect, even the mayor. He's not Parisian enough. So just looking quickly at some of the sites, Unilever House, which is on the site of that park I showed, Victorian image, here. That space is a potentially very interesting space. The road had been taken out. There's a pedestrian route here, which is getting you up towards St. Paul's. This is Blackfriars Bridge here. And we're looking at the idea of some sort of shelter, come bar, perhaps. I haven't talked to Nick Sroto or anybody about this, but perhaps something to do, some anticipation of the Tate as you're coming up to the Millennium Bridge here. And the city are looking at this and actually doing things to this part of their part of the Thames. Victoria Embankment is ending about there, and our project is starting.
It's starting there.
And that's part of Manchester. Maybe going back, I mean, maybe, you know, maybe this space has some kind of form that makes it a really nice space facing south and so on. And that is a kind of first image of the underside of Blackfriars Bridge, as you can see in the foreground. A long, elegant kind of shelter there, also protecting you from traffic noise to the north. And then many of you will experience the pleasure of Temple Station and and that little garden full of sort of, I think it's where blackbirds go to die, probably. That could be improved. There could be a much better relationship between Temple Station and Temple Gardens. And Temple Station's up for, you know, a lot of renewal. And there's that terrace at high level, which people may not be fully aware of here, with the Australian bar underneath. And that's potentially a really interesting place, the terrace itself. And maybe we could get a link from Somerset House Terrace down onto here. There's an addition to Somerset House, which I think is probably 1920s or 30s, not 18th century. So that's a sketch of how there might be a terrace with a roof over the Temple Station and the associated kind of bar. Also, there's a kind of idea here in this image, which I think is quite interesting, which is simply that some pattern in the pavement may just go right across both the pedestrian surfaces and the vehicular surfaces. And maybe, you know, although it's a strong pattern, maybe that is getting somewhere towards that notion, that sort of image, that snow image produced of a continuity of surface which is not dominated by vehicles. Somerset House, there is the old Watergate, which actually is an entrance, an exit onto the embankment, which is a real one. Waterloo Bridge, of course, flies over the top and has staircases that go down on the north side. But we've sort of begun to think of the idea that there might be lifts and stairs here and here, which perhaps are very elegant towers, glass towers, which are slightly distanced from Waterloo Bridge. I mean, this is not something I haven't begun to talk to English Heritage about, and probably is a bit of a no-no. But if they were distanced, and then there was a very slender bridge that came through the parapet into the tower, it just might work. And then embankment gardens themselves, trying to get these routes. I'm just going to go back, sorry. Yeah, you can see their routes. Sorry, I should have said there are strong ladder rungs, as you might say, and some of them we can make pedestrian and not vehicular, that are connecting up here to the Aldwych. And then various lanes, some of which are really difficult, actually. And the Adelphi itself, very high level. Maybe we can get stairs and even perhaps lifts down into Embankment Gardens from the end of Adam Street and Robert Street. And to go back to the earlier kind of remarks, perhaps somehow get the Embankment Gardens to feel as though they're an extension of the space of the embankment itself. Though this image still implies a lot of enclosure. Top right, a kind of very early sketch suggesting a continuity of surface into Embankment Gardens on the left, what it's like now. And then various images below of other gardens, ancient and modern, which have a feeling of openness. Carting Lane, I think you could make a strong connection to the Strand, but it's quite difficult. And again, I think that involving artists in spaces like this could be enormously effective. A very cheeky image at the bottom right of all the railings and all the dead bird shrubbery and everything's gone there. And you can see what it's like on the left, and much loved. We think that there's a big space underneath, next to Embankment Station, underneath the railway tracks going out across the bridge, which could be a farmer's market or something. And something I'm probably not going to talk about as much as I should, but transport, underground, buses, potentially perhaps trams, river transport. Very large uncertainties about how much river transport can be improved. I think up till fairly recently, the problem with river transport was that the very fast tides of the Thames make timekeeping for river transport very difficult, unless the river transport's very fast. The river transport's very fast, and the vessels are traditional. They make a tremendous wash, and there's real problems with the Port of London Authority about that. But hydrofoils don't make any wash at all. So there's still quite a lot of mileage in discussing that. And the signboard there is about future river transport. And then in front of MOD, there's an enormous expanse of space which might become recreational space and might have a cafe or something on it. And there needs to be a kind of really serious conservation management scheme for all of the embankment. It has an extraordinary wealth of historical artifacts and statues, which are very, very important to a kind of urban memory. That locates most of the important statues, including one of Bazalgette, number 21, which is very, very varied indeed. And coming very briefly, just sort of suggesting by some few images of interventions by artists, this is a project that you can see by modus operandi, which is called Light Up Queen Street in the City. And in this case, this is temporary work by Susan Collins. The world she's lighting up, which is rather appropriate to Bazalgette in a way, as a great sewer engineer, is the world of the drains underneath the streets. There's a permanent work by Andrea Blom, which is a pavement work, and a lot of the work that we did in Coventry with modus operandi was to do with surfaces. So there's a kind of way of working with artists which is not making objects and bronze statues of the famous and so on. It's a completely different kind of realm of work, and that's Coventry, and that's a work in the pavement which is a clock, actually, which is made up of the time zones of the world, and the LEDs in each time zone light up as the sun rises over that time zone. And it's about 60 meters across, and the whole thing is lit at midnight. And this is another temporary work which Modus Operandi commissioned, of film of people walking in the city down Queen Street and so on, and they kind of see their sort of doppelgangers walking in projections on buildings. And it's a film by an artist called Mark Lewis. And then in temporary and permanent works, the idea of lighting is very, very exciting, potentially, I think. I mean, one way you could almost start people thinking about the Victorian embankment before doing anything physical to it would be to light it in really interesting ways, as a temporary work. This is another Queen Street scheme by the artist David Ward, who we also worked with in Coventry, called Nocturne. Part of the illumination of this church is so pale and so much like a kind of night sky that, and I haven't talked to him about this, but it did make me think that perhaps he was thinking Whistler. So that's the sort of scope of the scheme and its connections to hinterland, its connections to the bridges. The very important aspect to this, something I talked about here, I think 2 years ago, was the idea that cities are, in some sense, recharged by the events that happen in them, that our memory of cities is about what happens. And I suggested in that lecture that what's interesting about Trafalgar Square is it sort of starts off as a commemoration of a particular event, Battle of Trafalgar. But it's constantly kind of connected to the psychic mains of the nation by either celebrations or riots. And that's why it just becomes very important, because these things keep charging it up. So the marathon does this for parts of London. The events that would be organized here are really important to what we think about it, what we remember about it. And of course, if it doesn't get done before the Olympics, it'll never get done. But it has great potentiality in relation to the Olympics, and that would be one way. I mean, I see the Olympics as an extraordinary memory charger for London. And finally, it's a kind of grandstand for events on the river. I said earlier, and perhaps haven't elaborated, but in a sense, its subject could be the river and what happens on the river. So that's kind of where we are. Thank you for listening.
Very much. It's always shocking how simple it would be just to stop cars and change the materials on surfaces to create something so wonderful. I'm going to invite two panelists up to generate the conversation and to react initially to Richard's talk. Professor David Frisby, who is Professor of Sociology and attached to the CITIS programme. David, if you come to come up, who writes about architecture and experience in the modern city, and Dr. Margaret Richardson, who is an eminent architectural historian and was formerly curator of the Soane Museum, not so very far away from here. So, Margaret, I think if we start with an architectural historian's reaction, and then we'll move on to the theory.
Well, perhaps Richard has touched about history quite a few times, but perhaps if I could also recover some of that. Just to say, obviously, as we all know, in the 17th and 18th centuries, the river was the road, and anyone, if they were going anywhere, went on the river. And the embankment area there, 17th and 18th century, was basically wharves and things like that, but also some of the grand houses, Montague House, Northumberland House, would have gardens that would go right down to the river, and there'd be a wall at the end of the garden, and of course steps where they would take their boats. And the Temple Gardens went right down to the river, and the Temple Gardens, of course, are still there, but cut off by the embankment now. So, and of course, in those days, the Thames was actually a clean river. People could go fishing, fishing for salmon, which is always apparently the test of a clean river, and they enjoyed the open air and all that kind of thing. So, and then Somerset House, which we've seen, when Chambers designed that, although it was government offices, the public were allowed into the central courtyard and also onto the fine terrace which he constructed above the vaults below where boats could come in. And so that was really a sort of quite a democratic thing, you know, sort of it was seen, the river was seen then at that time as Venice, it was like Venice. And so you looked over the river in that wonderfully close way that, that Venice has. That was followed, of course, by the Adelphi, which was a wonderful scheme where terrace houses, Robert Adam and his brother were acting as developers, making terrace houses along the Thames, overlooking what is now the embankment, and they had a terrace where people could go and stand. And also they had vaults where all the deliveries to the houses came under vaults from the river. So again, that was quite interesting, and I think it had a lot of influence on people. Certainly it must have had an influence on Charles Barry. When he designed the Houses of Parliament, he put them straight on the edge of the river, and that involved a lot of pile driving, just as the Adelphi and Somerset House had. So he reclaimed that little bit of land and put the building there. And one wonders if that gave Mr. Bazalgette the idea in the 1860s of what to do about the riverfront. Because you see, the whole reason for the Victorian embankment was to try and clean the river, which was called the Great Stink, I think, at the time. I mean, it was colossally dirty, and the smell of it was absolutely appalling. And people were terribly worried about infection and disease coming from that river. So the real reason for the embankment is the great sewer that ran along the riverfront underneath the part, the embankment part. Next to it was the Metropolitan Railway, which was another important thing, but I don't think quite as important as the sewage part. And then, of course, they covered it up with a road, you know, brick and so on, and created this wonderful road and all the gardens. And they made a big thing about that. And the real reason, of course, was what lay under it, but they made a great thing about it being a ceremonial route from Mansion House to Westminster. And they created Queen Victoria Street, another big road, which would enable the route from Mansion House to be an easy one to Blackfriars Bridge and then on. They also created lots and lots of other roads, which we forget about. I mean, they created Northumberland Avenue, leading down to the embankment. What else? I mean, Victoria Street, and so on. A lot of roads were created by them in that same movement to improve traffic, although and of course, they were worried about the traffic on the Strand and Fleet Street, which apparently was very crowded. And they thought that this road, the Victorian Embankment, would relieve all that. So it was very, very practical in terms of traffic. And they dressed it up and they made it very beautiful with its wonderful granite walls and an embankment and so forth, and the gardens, which are very formal and have remained almost the same since that day, and all the trees and so on. And at first, it was a very prestige place, and big hotels were there. The Hotel Cecil was there, and then the Savoy, you know, and all that sort of thing along there. So we mustn't forget all that. You know, that was, it is a, and it still is sort of a prestige place. The Cecil, I think it was Shelmeck's house that took the place of, so big business came into it all at that point. Prestige building. Although, fortunately, what we have the precedent now of prestige buildings also being on the South Bank. So I don't think that the North Bank is the only place which can have prestige things. So you have a situation where the Victorian embankment, as Richard has said, is almost very sterile for these prestige reasons, I think. But I think what really has been very influential is the whole battle for Covent Garden, which happened in the early 70s. You know, people wanted to wipe that away, create a great new thoroughfare down Garrick Street, and so on. And so many people fought for Covent Garden and to keep it just as it is, to keep all its little nooks and crannies and all sorts of things like that. And they were successful. So that I don't think any grand road schemes have really been ever considered recently at all. Just to finish, I would just like to say that I very much wish that Richard would take it a bit further and do something, make proposals about the traffic, because it is appalling, the roads. It's used as a rat run now from the city. How do you get from the city? Quickly, you go down Victoria Embankment. But what you could do is, first of all, you've got the option to just have a one-way system. Because what was very interesting about the Edwardian period was the tram lines. The tram lines ran over Westminster Bridge, down the South Bank, over Blackfriars Bridge, and then along the embankment, forming a great loop. So you could do the same with a one-way route, actually. Or you could do, for example, sometimes, I don't know whether you've ever taken a taxi from Westminster, if you want to go to the city, it's often quicker and easier to go over, cross the bridge and go the South Bank way, come back over Blackfriars Bridge or even over Waterloo Bridge. So that I'm sure you can divide the traffic, perhaps, if one could come up with a good scheme. But of course, the really great thing would be to have no traffic there. And I think one ought to go for it. I mean, if one's serious about traffic in London, I mean, it would just be such a wonderful thing to have Richard's scheme without the traffic. Anyway.
Right, thank you. I think if I could just follow on from that, I came to the first of the lectures in this series, which was on the King's Cross development. And one thing which struck me there was how dependent that the success of that was on trying to break down the massive traffic barriers of Euston Road around King's Cross. King's Cross is a kind of an end point of a mass of traffic coming in all different directions. And I fully agree. I think that one of the I think the project as a whole is an excellent one, but it is to a very, very large extent contingent upon solving the traffic problem. And it strikes me that if when I look at my 1910 Baedeker guide to London, and I look at where should one go to see new developments. And the new developments listed then were the Victoria Embankment, still, Kingsway, Queen Victoria Street, and as an interesting development, although quite an old one, Holborn Viaduct. Now what they all have in common is, perhaps then, but certainly now, is that they're overburdened with traffic. And if you take the example which we are located on here, Kingsway, Kingsway itself, although it has a heavy traffic congestion, has been transformed in recent years, partly by LSE students looking for somewhere to have a coffee or something, so the place is now full of coffee bars, and in summer people sit out, breathing in the noxious fumes, and still drinking their coffee and thinking it's healthy because at least they're outside. Whereas I think the Richard's suggestion for the embankment is a crucial one, that is to try to where possible to increase and if not double the space available for pedestrians and pedestrian activity. I think this is absolutely crucial. If one looks back at the completion of the Victoria Embankment, it's interesting to note that many people complained about what was not on the embankment. And what was not on the embankment was shops and bars. And I think that you've gone part of the way to address that, either in terms of conceiving of open markets, small open markets, which is very successful in other cities. But also the idea of having places where almost where people can rest, the cafe and so on. At the same time, it seems to me that the historical perspective on the embankment is a perspective on a grand avenue which at the time had lots of grand buildings on it and actually quite a lot of private residences. Now it must have virtually no private residences and has lots of grand buildings and enclosed spaces that are not always open to the public. Okay, I'm thinking of the grand hotels, the conversion of the Adelphi into offices, the Leverhulme building, the Inns of Court, of course, which are partly accessible. And in this context, I think it's very important to, as you've suggested, to move, to withdraw and try to remove some of the shrubbery around those buildings, okay, so that you actually do have, you open up the greenery that is available. It seems to me that this is quite crucial because it changes the perspective on the as you're moving around along the embankment. This afternoon, in order to demonstrate to myself that the embankment was still there, I went for a walk and I stood on the Adelphi Terrace and looked down and actually couldn't see most of the embankment because of the trees. But I then went down a very narrow staircase or stairwell onto the embankment. It seems to me that one of the problems of the embankment as it exists, and one of the things we think you address, is that access to it needs to be opened up in other ways, so that at present it isn't an easy access from the Strand into the embankment or vice versa, even for pedestrians. Which brings me back also to the issue of traffic again. I think one needs to think of ways in which the discrepancy in the speed of traffic, of vehicular traffic and pedestrians is somehow regulated. Maybe slowing down the traffic, restricting the speed. Because otherwise it seems to me that one is going to have, in a sense, the problem of Kingsway if you don't do that. You're just going to have fast traffic and people sitting in cafes and wondering why the pollution is as high as it is. In the context of traffic, I also wonder whatever one does in terms of restricting traffic on the embankment, what are the implications of this for that other grand avenue that you showed, which was, in fact, Fleet Street to the Strand? In the late 19th century, of course, both Fleet Street and the Strand in particular were very important shopping areas. And that is no longer, I think, the case. So there is an issue about, on the one hand, the total desirability of regulating traffic in some way. But then every time one does that, you then find that the problem of traffic emerges somewhere else. Maybe a one-way circular route might be an answer. It is interesting, historically, how short a period there was, in fact, public transport on the embankment. The tramway was opened in 1906 and it was closed in 1953, a relatively short period. So that, in fact, what we're looking at on the embankment is, in fact, private transport and not public one. The other thing which strikes me about the embankment is, of course, its historical artifacts. You've revealed very interestingly the mass of statuary that is available along that space, and also the connections to empire, which were part of the embellishments of that street in the late 19th century. In general, I would very much welcome your plan, but I think, like you, the greatest problem being the success in regulating the traffic.
Okay, well, This seems to be fairly straightforward. It's less traffic and more trees. But I suppose the first thing to say in relation to the trees is that it's very interesting when one looks at the John O'Connor painting of around sort of 1878, I think it is, where there's a view from Somerset House River Terrace looking down on the embankment, and you see troops marching along it, and then the plane trees, which are reasonably small, almost shrub-like things at that stage. They, of course, have grown considerably. I think plane trees, I understand, live to about 250 years, and they're obviously only about halfway through their life at the moment, but they're already very big. And I suppose the intriguing problem is that if you plant more trees, you're going to get more shrouding, more concealment, unless one is very selective about where those trees are planted. Because I think one of the issues that you've raised about why is it more enjoyable to walk on the South Bank than the North Bank, the traffic is certainly one issue, but there is a sense of openness and there's a sense of engagement, I think, as the panelists have suggested, in relation to the public buildings that are along there. Do you want to...?
Trees and traffic. The tree, we've got a lot more work to do to know, to really understand the viability of putting in more trees, because there's some very sort of particular issues that maybe one wouldn't think of initially. For example, you have to have tree canopies above transport, and those tree canopies have to be above double-decker tourist buses. So you've got to find a tree that grows in a rather odd kind of way. I'm not sure we've found it yet. But you can obtain quite mature trees now. The other sort of comment, slightly sort of digressive one, is the London planes that have been planted downriver from the National Theatre and so on are extraordinarily kind of vigorous looking, actually. And they've been there, 25 years or something like that? Whereas the trees on the Victoria Embankment look pretty sick, actually. But I don't think I'm brave enough to say, let's tear them all out. That's how you lose a job. And you also lose a job if you say you can get rid of all the traffic, by the way. on the traffic, because there's an image behind, you know, sort of hovering in relation to all this. To do with the 1973 Royal Academy exhibition, Foster Sterling celebration, I didn't expect. Foster Sterling and Rogers, and of course Richard Rogers proposed putting all traffic into a large kind of tube under the Thames. And Richard is very supportive of this scheme, but I sort of get a very strong feeling he thinks that tube was the best idea. Margaret made some very interesting ideas about how one might radically think about the traffic. At the moment, we're sort of, rather caught in a situation where the expectation is this goes on being what it's always been, which is a vehicular archery. But we have to plan it in such a way that in a future situation, and it may be nearer than we think, the amount of traffic you really have to get onto it is much less. And maybe one starts as actually testing that by closing two lanes on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday, and maybe more, and have one way or something. And the whole idea of trying to get the surfaces for vehicles and surfaces for pedestrians as much alike each other as possible seems to me to be a kind of slightly subversive way of getting towards that idea.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any responses from the floor? Yes.
Imposed at other times. I don't know whether you're aware, in Hong Kong, underneath the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, where all these Filipino au pairs collect on weekends, The density of their occupation underneath the building and the plaza surrounding has become so great that now all the surrounding roads are shut on Sundays and people just picnic in the roads. And, you know, notwithstanding your relative discomfort about walking up the mall and not feeling quite safe, it can work if it's got to work and if the protocols surrounding it are supported. And I think that is a very important idea. You know, I think the embankment performs a different role on the weekend from that that it performs during the week, and that you should explore that more assertively.
What, get all London's au pairs to come sit in the road? No, it's being serious. No, I think actually, I mean, the point you're making is a really interesting one, that some events that cause the space to be, as it were, totally reallocated and to have a sort of new image, because that's what you're saying. There's a kind of expediency in Hong Kong that's done something absolutely wonderful for that area. Actually, I was there this time last year, and I didn't see the streets closed down. I saw all the young women sitting underneath the bank. That was extraordinary.
Well, I think that we're sort of swapped in Robert Black Hats on occasion.
Richard, hi. Just a couple of observations. Back at the beginning of your lecture, you mentioned the difference between walking along the South Bank and the North Bank. I mean, I've done similar trip as yourself, and it appears to me that the connection that you have, and Robert alluded to that in his opening comments, is that you have a greater sense of the view of the river and obviously of the buildings on the North Bank and the sense of openness, but you have spaces, or places rather than just spaces. Whereas on the North Bank, you also seem rather higher as well. I don't know if that's true, whether the Victorian embankment is higher above the mean level of the river. You feel very disengaged because of all the junk that's along the river. From the water face. So have you, in your layering and thoughts about using and widening the pedestrian realm, you didn't touch on how you redefine the edge of that bank with the river. What is the junction between the water and the land? Mm. Are you accepting that the embankment there is a fait accompli and that's it? Because when you walk along it, you don't get any sense of the water. It's just this chasm to the south bank. Yeah. I was wondering whether you introduced a layer between the embankment and the river.
Well, that's very interesting. I should have said something about that, because we have thought about it. I don't think the embankment on the north side is higher. I mean, both embankments are threatened by tidal floods and so forth, and I think they're probably the same height. But one thing that does happen is that I think it's to do actually with the natural scouring effect of the tides. I may be wrong about this, I'm slightly guessing, but the outside of the river, the outside of the curve, will be scoured, because that's where the rapidity of the tide is. And so the water's deeper there, and you don't get exposed shore like you do on the south bank, where you get even quite clean, sort of even quite sandy areas. And I suppose the Great Bazalgette Scheme has done is cut off a sort of relationship which Londoners could have had with the river if it had been a gradual slope down to the river. The other sort of thought that we've had, one other thought, one was to sort of cantilever out over the embankment. That's a sort of no-no with the PLA, because boats can get stuck under the cantilever, you know, which is an amusing thought. The other is to improve, is to actually open up all the remarkable. I didn't mention this either, but we've gone on too long. But there are these wonderful staircases that go down between massive walls to what would have been, and still in some cases are, floating pontoons, which gave access to the steamers that plied up and down the river in the early part of the last century. Why did all that work economically? Because they weren't very fast. But that was how people got into work, even in the, you know, up to, I'm not sure when, possibly up to late 1940s, I don't know. So there are possibilities of getting onto the water, which I should have talked about. But I referred rather dismissively to the kind of rather sad collection of old boats and bits and pieces and terrible bits of pier and these beautiful stone pieces of stone infrastructure which would have gone to the original pontoons are blocked up and sort of full of dead pigeons and so on and so forth. So yes, we should be looking at getting onto the level of the water.
The one problem with the Victorian bank here is that there's a known
natural reason for pedestrians to go along there. It isn't a natural route. Even if the traffic wasn't there, I don't think the footfall would increase that much at the moment. So we've got to think of a way, what's going to encourage you to be there. One of the disadvantages it's got is actually the drop down from, say, the Strand down to the riverfront. I remember when I used to work around here that the effort to go down there and eat lunch and then come back up again, it seems a long way. So what can we do on the riverfront to attract people down there? And it occurred to me that one of the possibilities is maybe actually to have a high-level walk at bridge level along the front of the embankment and have bridges across the roadway which link you into the Strand or Fleet Street so you haven't got as big a drop and you've got a new experience there that you don't get somewhere else. You know, you're not going to compete with the South Bank with all those restaurants and things. You know, the North Bank can't. So let's try and give it something different, something that you can't get somewhere else and something that's easily accessible. People want to go on the bridges. If you make it easy for them to walk off the bridge along the same height, maybe we'll encourage them, give them a reason to go there.
Yeah, yes, your opening comment that it doesn't make kind of connections is a really, in a way, is an important one. But I doubt that the South Bank makes very useful connections. I think it's just turned out to be a very nice place to walk along recreationally on a weekend, and I think that's what we have to do in the North Bank. I mean, it might just be a very different kind of experience and a very different kind of place, and it may be, you know, it won't be. I mean, maybe there are places in cities which are actually, this is a slightly tricky remark, it sounds rather as though I'm trying to slip out of an argument, in which I probably have, which is that there are places and cities which are rather good because there aren't an awful lot of people there. I did have a bit of a set-to with Splendid People and Space Syntax some time ago where I was involved in a scheme and they said nobody's going to go down there, and I said that's what's really nice about it. I think it has to have more supporting functions and pleasurable functions. Something I'm very kind of preoccupied with at the moment is a quality of pavement surface along that promenade, which is of a kind that simply hasn't been seen in England at the kind of scale of the development. I mean, there's a kind of paving which... let's think of examples. Around the Foster Swissery building, there's a surface of pavement which is very slight gradient. It's actually a very, very shallow cone. And the quality of the surface is entirely different to your usual sort of slightly bobbly York stone. It's a completely geometrically precise, and it's very beautiful. I think Alice Morrison did some paving outside Tate Britain. It's on the left, which is, I think, is Portland stone. And it's absolutely precise. And actually, the Foster project for Spitalfields has some incredibly good paving. It sounds rather rude to say that Foster's very good at paving, but I mean, they is very good at paving. And so I sort of envisage a kind of surface that has a quality which is so amazing. It would just be a very beautiful place to be. It might attract people, but it's very, very beautiful.
Yes.
I think the comments that we should downgrade the traffic are quite wrong, and I'm really supportive of what you're suggesting is to make both the pedestrians and the traffic environment coexist better. And I think it's very, very clever what you've suggested to give more of a buffer. Because some of the most glamorous places in the world, at the end of the Champs-Élysées, for example, fantastic speed and quantity of traffic, but also such a generous space for pedestrians. And one of the most wonderful experiences in the city is to be going down a big carriageway in a cab at night and see all the lights of all the cars, but also know that there's something interesting going on beside you. And the possibility of both the things coexisting is what makes it both nice for pedestrians for a certain kind of space and also a richer experience driving through the city, which a lot of us are doing in any case. I wouldn't have made the lecture on time tonight if I hadn't been able to take a cab along Victoria Embankment. So I think it can be a better experience for both those parties. And in regard of that, the one thing that's you touched on but didn't go into in any detail was how dense and scruffy some of the gardens that are on the embankment are. And they stop us from connecting to the prestigious buildings that were referred to. And if that was opened up more, is there any thought that perhaps those buildings, the Grand Hotels, for example, which have a natural public function, might enliven part of the space? Was that part of your thinking about this?
Yes, just taking that first. In a way, of course, the most obvious example is the Savoy. And you would expect the Savoy to have a very strong relationship to the Embankment Gardens to the south. And I went, just walked along that little road that runs along the edge of the Savoy, and between the Savoy and the Embankment Gardens, and it's a railing along the Embankment Gardens. And you know, that's a great hotel, and you would have expected that it actually had, it addressed some kind of public space, which actually being right at the very point, the downriver end of the Embankment Gardens, is actually, I would have thought, quite, you know, really very feasible, actually. Going back to the traffic, I think what you've said is very important. I think that that certain there are cities that have made traffic very exciting, Barcelona, Madrid, actually, in Paris are obvious examples, and the traffic still represents a kind of vitality. So I think there's too much traffic on the Victoria Embankment, and I think that if we could change the mode, and one had a mode of the embankment during the rush hours, during the weekdays, being a working traffic environment, and then on Saturdays and Sundays being a recreational, non-traffic environment, start to actually create something rather rich. Gosh, you know, traffic is such a difficult thing. And there are sort of assumptions that even big roads are completely sort of non-negotiable, and that you have to sacrifice parts of cities to fast road systems. And I mean, currently I've been musing, because it's not a project we have, but musing on the way the A13 enters Canning Town. And I think there's a sort of assumption, you know, that that's going to be a terrible space. But the curious thing, which somebody reminded me of fairly recently, was that one of the most valuable, highest property priced residential places in London, has a four-lane carriageway racing through the middle of it. And I'm talking about Eaton Square. And it's quite interesting.
Thank you very much. I think I'm afraid there we're going to have to leave it. I mean, we obviously wish you well with your negotiations with Transport for London and English Heritage, but I guess in the end this is a vote for congestion charging. So thank you very much, Richard, David, and Margaret. Thank you very much.